where did you get such a love for critters and nature?
You know, I think it was just very early on. I was kind of just born that way. You know, it's funny, family pictures, old family pictures. I was a very serious little guy, and our family, you know, we laugh about it when the baby pictures come up of me, because there's, you know, little Mr. Businessman Rob, you know. But if there was a dog around, I was reaching out and trying to get near it. So, and, you know, I'm somewhat of an introvert, and certainly as a teenager, I had issues, and I had troubles, and nature was a place where I felt really comfortable. But, you know, I think a lot of it was when I started writing poetry and really looking with detail, and not just with the mind, but with the heart, and also painting houses gave me a chance to really see nature in a different way. I had always been afraid, you mentioned the spider webs, I had always been really afraid of spiders, but I had to overcome that as a painter, because the exterior of a house is like a little ecosystem. You know, it's a vertical plane, so to speak, and spiders love it, because they can hang a web between a soffit and a wall, right, and then catch all the bugs going by. And you also often find yourself having painted one by accident, and that's a very, you know, you see them crawling around trying to get out of this goop. So I've become very conscientious about brushing away all the spiders. But it showed me a hidden world I hadn't seen before.
Yeah. There's also a paint story or a clay story about mm-hmm. this actual cover of the book. Tell us about that.
Yeah, so I've developed a love for native clays or wild clays. And those are clays that exist in our environment, and you often find them by riverbanks, and you can harvest them, and you can process them, and then they become a beautiful paint medium or a plaster medium. And this is very ancient. I'm not doing anything new. And I kind of have developed, you know, a certain love for these clays. They're they have their own personality, so to speak. The smell of a clay is flinty and clean. And when you first add water to the clay, you hear all this popping and sizzling. As clay is a real water-loving material. And it's fascinating to me that clay comes from something as hard as stone. It's this long, long process. So clay is extremely ancient. And so in my interest of clay, I found myself, when taking a trip to Denver, just seeing clay everywhere, you know, along the road banks. And beautiful clays in the Southwest. So I started collecting them. You know, I'd stop at the side of the road and grab a coffee cup or whatever and put some clay in it. And I collected about 30 or so different colors. And I just decided, well, I'll make the cover of a book using these clays. The title and the lettering is Red Clay from the Black Hills. And it's some of the most beautiful clay I've ever seen. I took just a small amount, and I've been respectful in using it. I don't feel like I was stealing anything. For me, it makes the book that much more special.
That much more authentic.
Yeah, authentic. I think that's what I was trying to do.
Yeah. You have poems and an essay on your kayaktivism, which mm-hmm. is a new word that we've invented in the last couple of years. Can you talk about your experience protesting on the water? You say it's the most sane thing you can do in the face of such insanity.
Yeah, so this was when Shell Oil had brought their Arctic drilling rigs into local ports and harbors en route to the Chukchi Sea. In the Arctic to explore for oil. And there was a secondary drill rig called the Noble Discoverer in the port of Everett, next to the Everett Naval Base. And Carla Voli, a local activist, was organizing a vigil and put out a call for help. So I went down. And it wasn't easy. I had to get up at 2 in the morning and drive down. But as we were sitting there on the water, I started just I had lots of time to really think about what's going on in this world, and that was 2015. It was an extremely dry and warm spring, and by June, which is when we were doing this vigil, salmon were starting to die in the Klamath River, and I could feel that the water was strangely sickly warm, and I could also feel that year, that summer is when the climate crisis to me went from conceptual to visceral. I could feel it, and I think a lot of people could feel it. So to see an Arctic drilling rig getting prepared to go drill more of this heat-trapping carbon, it was just the epitome of insanity to me. And it was not only the fact that this rig was going out there, but the fact that our Coast Guard, which is supposed to be guarding our coast, was protecting a foreign corporation to go put our coast at extreme risk. So it seemed a kind of insanity to me. And I didn't really know what to do. I think we all have this feeling of powerlessness. Where do we begin? What do we do? But sitting on that boat, on that water, staring at that rig was real. And I was ready to give it everything I could to stop that thing. And it was helpful.
You know, you use the word powerlessness. And, you know, I think of that Bruce Coburn song from the 80s about U.S. policy in Central America.
Yeah.
And the devastation that it wrought. And he's got a song called If I Had a Rocket Launcher, right? Some son of a bitch would die.
Some son of a bitch would die.
And, you know, you hear that and you're like, right on,
yeah,
I'm with
right,
you.
Yeah.
But violence doesn't change anything. And the right baits the left. And it's a classic technique of fascists to bait the left until they become violent. And then that's where they pull out the big guns and they have the rocket launchers. So with this notion of powerlessness, you hear a Bruce Coburn song and you think, that's power. But what is power to you? You felt powerlessness for a moment, but you also, in the celebration afterwards, and maybe you didn't stop it, but you did something about it. To you, how do you define power?
Well, there's long-term and short-term power. Yeah, in the short term, the ones with the guns have the power. I think Mao said power comes from the barrel of the gun. But in the long term, the ones who are linked to what endures have the power. And you hope in a moral universe, the ones who are aligned to moral principles have the power. You know, I think that's how Martin Luther King felt that his dreams and goals were inevitable, because he saw the power in them. And I think we have that too. I think one thing we fail to realize in environmentalism, and I use that word in scare quotes, is that we don't, you know, we talk so much about solar panels and green energy technology and things like that, but our power really comes from the fact that we're aligned with the powers of the earth. We're aligned with the sun. We're aligned with the seasons. We're aligned with childhood. We're aligned with everything that makes life beautiful. And we need to realize that power and find an ideation and a language for that power. So we're no longer just this this category called environmentalism off the side of this economic program, but we're more at the center of things. I saw a beautiful video from a guy who went and recorded what happened after Exxon Valdez. And he has this great line. He says, "Remember, brave warriors, we have the home field advantage." And I think that's true. And I think it's true not just in a physical sense, but in a spiritual sense, an intellectual sense.
Nature bats last.
Yeah.
Yeah. In the poem Facing Water, near the end of the book, page 102, by the way, there's a line that says, you know what, maybe we should read the poem and talk about it after. Yeah.
Facing Water, 1. The tide seeps in like a secret, telling one pebble at a time. 2. Reflecting a cool, distant sun, cloud light silvers the ripples as they slide past the firs, made candelabras by the perched herons, the pace steady, stately, like a public processional. And isn't this a kind of public? Am I not facing the true civilization? 3. Behind me a great democracy stutters. Our votes become tickets to a carnival that periodically sweeps through town. Your choice, waffle cone or funhouse mirror, haunted castle or whirling teacup with a wheel in the middle to make it feel like you are steering. 4. Here the crab has cast its ballot, an empty shell on the beach. The sun lowers and gives rise to the moon. Sand grains walk with mountains. 5. Time perhaps to leave off perfecting the union and turn again to perfected creation. The robin on the fence post doesn't need a plan. The flower growing in the pavement crack will bring the revolution.
So there are two references. A great democracy stutters, and perhaps it's time perhaps to leave off perfecting the union. Is the United States a lost cause?
No, but I think it's become a silly distraction. You know, I don't think the United States is a lost cause. I don't think it's a very important cause, to be honest with you. I don't think nationalism is an important cause. And I think a lot of people are getting rich, getting us all to argue about what America is and isn't. And it's become increasingly meaningless to me. We're certainly nothing without the land base. And
we're doing our best to fuck that up.
We're doing our best to mess it up. Yep.
It's been a real delight to get
to know
you.
It's been great.
And I'm very grateful that you came to be part of this.
It's been a delight, and thanks for having me.